I want to welcome everybody back to the Fitz News Studio for our week in review. Tis time to get things rolling. We've got a lot to cover this week. We've got Bowen Turner news. We've got developments in the Brittany Drexel case that we want to talk about. We've got some information on gas prices, gas taxes that are hitting South Carolina motorists harder than ever. Motorists across the country, really. And we're also going to talk about a drug bust that involves a taco. Dylan has got a taco for me to eat or something. I don't know. We'll see what that's all about. But all that and more headed your way on the Week in Review. All right. So as we did last week, we're going to start again this week with the story of Bowen Turner. Now, this story is bigger than Bowen Turner, and that's something that became readily apparent from the very beginning. We've got all the ingredients of South Carolina's broken judicial system present in this one case, people. We've got, you know, terrible bond decisions. We've got weak sentencing. We've got politically connected lawyers who are also legislators, the people who appoint the judges, getting sweetheart deals for their clients. But this story is even bigger than that. There was a component to it involving the state's ankle monitoring process, which it turns out there is no monitoring, okay? And lawmakers astoundingly agreed this year, in the House of Representatives, Republicans in the House of Representatives, agreed this year to give people credit for time served on an ankle monitor that they're not even monitoring. So again, absolutely ridiculous, totally unfair to victims, totally detrimental to public safety. But again, the case is much bigger than Bowen Turner, much bigger than Bowen Turner. We've known that from the beginning. But this week we saw it escalate in another level, in the legal level, into a battle over the state constitution, a battle over the law governing the powers of prosecutors in South Carolina. And so we were the very first to report on this. We're the very first to report on the fallout from it. And so I wanted to walk you through this because it does matter, because this is a huge case. And as mentioned, the case is much bigger than just one guy and the crimes that he's been accused of. So let's walk you through what happened. As most of you know by now, Bowen Turner, 19-year-old from Orangeburg, South Carolina, was accused of raping three different victims over a period of a little over a year back in 2018 and 2019. This case made national news back in April when Turner was given a sweetheart probationary deal thanks to the work of his attorney, who was powerful lawyer, legislator Brad Hutto. Hutto is, in fact, the Senate Minority Leader, a very influential man in state government here in South Carolina. So this probationary sentence created outrage. In addition to that, outrage over the sentence, one of the rape cases against Bowen Turner was dropped at the time that he received this sweetheart plea deal. So a lot of outrage over that. Obviously, attention drawn to this case that probably you wouldn't see on a lot of other cases because of how high profile it was. But as we dug into this story, and as we started looking at these charges that were filed against him, and as victims' advocates started to stand up and challenge some of these rulings, and victims' attorneys, in fact, appealing some of these rulings, we started to look at the line of authority in this case. And what we found was incredibly interesting. What we found, folks, was that two of the three sexual assault cases, rape cases, against Bowen Turner were not properly assigned to the solicitor who had the authority. Or let me rephrase that, because this is important. Two of the three cases were not properly assigned to a solicitor from the one who did have the authority to prosecute, meaning that the one who had the cases, based on my reading of the law, my reading of the state constitution, did not have the authority to handle them. Now, this is a big deal, folks, because, again, one of these cases was dropped, and it impacts both the plea, it impacts the sentencing, impacts the whole thing. And so we started digging into this, and I reached out to the First Circuit solicitor, whose name is David Pasco, and I want to get into a little bit of that exchange because he was quite fired up when we published our story detailing how these cases were improperly transferred. All right, so Solicitor Pasco from Orangeburg County has a statewide name. This guy has been at the center of a major anti-corruption investigation involving multiple politicians at the South Carolina State House. He's been in our studio on several occasions. We've interviewed him before. He's somebody that we turn to frequently on cases, and someone who is obviously in the news for the cases that he handles, the cases he transfers. So Pasco is a guy who is very well known in South Carolina legal circles. He was an aspiring contender for Attorney General of South Carolina. Ultimately, he decided not to run this year, probably a good decision based on the electoral landscape for Democrats. But nonetheless, Pascoe's a guy I've always gotten along with, and a guy who I felt during that corruption investigation a few years ago did a pretty good job. He was successful in rooting out some of the Republican leaders in the South Carolina General Assembly who were playing fast and loose with your money and who were profiting off of their positions in public office. And so he did a good job in holding them accountable. Now, the problem, as I've repeatedly pointed out, is that Pascoe only got the job half done. He did not go after the special interests that were pulling the strings of those politicians. In fact, he let those folks off the hook. And so I have criticized him for that while crediting him for the work that he did do. So anyway, long story short, I liked the guy. Always liked him, always gotten along with him. And so I was surprised when I reached out to him on this, and he was very upset with the angle that we pursued. And then once we published our story, very upset with the coverage. Now, Pascoe's argument against, you know, our report was that he has a reciprocal agreement with the Second Circuit solicitor, a guy named Bill Weeks. Obviously, a lot of folks know Bill Weeks' name because he's the one who made these controversial decisions in the Bowen Turner case. And Bill Weeks has been under a lot of pressure, folks. A lot of folks have been calling on him to revisit these decisions. He is facing political pressure, the likes of which he has never experienced in his career. And that's a good thing, folks. That means people are holding him accountable for the terrible decisions that he made in the Bowen Turner case. But going back to whether or not he had the authority to handle those cases in the first place, I want to go back to something that Pascoe said. Because Pascoe, in responding to our story, didn't just give us a quote, didn't just, you know, call me, say a few things. He went off, people. He submitted a letter to the editor of this news outlet, one that was pretty hot, one that made some pretty interesting comments. And in fact, at the end of his letter, there's something I wanted to address after he talked about this reciprocal agreement. He made a comment that I felt was very, very important and worth addressing. He made this political, and I wanted to read what the solicitor had to say here. As a journalist, I understand that you won't divulge your source, but I have no doubt Alan Wilson or his office is behind the opinion piece. It's irresponsible for him to conduct business that way. If he has a problem with how solicitors send cases to other circuits, he needs to address us in person, not in the press. Providing a story and statutory law to a news outlet in order to get a sensational headline isn't how an attorney general's office should conduct business. This is particularly true when there is still a pending investigation. I want to address this, folks. This assumes that I'm too dumb to come up with the idea that, wait a minute, let's go back and look at the origins of these cases. It next assumes that I'm too dumb to look up the state constitution that governs how cases like this should be transferred in the event there's a conflict. It also assumes that I'm too dumb to look at South Carolina statutory law and look at the statute which specifically outlines the rules under which one solicitor can send a case to another solicitor. So Mr. Pascoe is right. I don't discuss sources, but I will tell you who the source was on this story. It was me looking into these cases, trying to find out exactly whether the authority to prosecute them was properly assigned. Because this is a huge deal, and I want to explain why. Let's assume for a moment that the Bowen Turner case had gone to trial. Okay? And a lot of people wanted that. A lot of people felt that should have happened. I felt that should have happened. I don't think that the prosecutors in this case should have ever taken this weak plea agreement that the lawyer-legislator Brad Hutto pushed on them. I don't think they should have taken that deal at all. I think they should have tried this case. But let me tell you something about what could have happened. Brad Hutto could have stood up the moment a jury was struck and said, Your Honor, I object. This case needs to be dismissed because the prosecutor who is sitting across from me isn't authorized to bring these charges. And now that this jury has been struck, double jeopardy attaches, which means they can't try Bowen Turner again. Once a jury is struck, people, that's the game. You got to try the case or else you got to let him go. So that is a potentially real consequence. Now, would that have happened? Would a judge have ruled that way? I don't know. I can't say. But it's a risk. It's a huge risk. And the only way to mitigate that risk is to make sure that you properly assign the authority for prosecutors. And what really amazes me about this whole case is that Solicitor Pascoe, again, a guy I like, a guy I hope to continue crediting when he does good things, and he does a lot of good things. I'm not trying to dog him out here, but one of the things that amazes me is that coming after me, trying to invent some political reason for us reporting this story, he says, and I want to quote this, he says that he hopes that our story will help provide a better, more uniform procedure. And he says he applauds the piece because it may start that dialogue. Applauds us. So on the one hand, he's applauding us. On the other hand, you know, bashing us and trying to say we created this for some political thing. So I don't know where he's coming from, folks, but I will tell you one thing. This is a very important issue, not only for this case, but for victims across South Carolina, for high-profile cases where solicitors have conflicts and have to transfer them. There has to be a process. And here's the thing, and this is what I don't think Solicitor Pasco gets. There is a process. It's called the state constitution, which specifically gives authority over all prosecutions in South Carolina to the Office of the Attorney General. And then there's the process in the Code of Laws, which specifically says if a solicitor wants to transfer, that is the call, the specific word is the call of the Attorney General. And there are, I'm told, hundreds of letters in the Attorney General's office where solicitors with prosecutors, including Bill Weeks, have sent letters asking them to transfer the case. And those are typically rubber stamped or approved. So I don't understand why this is such a big deal. And I don't understand why the solicitor didn't just ask for permission before he transferred the case. But again, we're going to get to that because it created a huge blow up. Huge political blow up in this state, huge conflict between the Attorney General and the solicitor, and it's going to be a big deal across the state as the 16 solicitors in South Carolina have to get together and work on a better system for making sure that when they have conflicts, that they transfer these cases correctly because the stakes are too high, and we cannot have another reason, another way for violent criminals or people like Bowen Turner to get off the hook. We have to make sure they're held accountable, and that means doing it by the book. All right, so now that I've bored everybody to death with the legalese about how cases are transferred from one circuit to another in South Carolina, I wanted to talk about an even bigger development related to the Bowen Turner case. Now, we're going to jump from procedural minutiae and political arguments to a real big deal, which is the reform that must come from this case, the reform that must come from thousands of cases like this, in which you've got violent criminals who are shown unfair lenience at the expense of public safety, to the detriment of the victims. And so I wanted to talk briefly about that process because there were some big developments in that process this week. As readers of our news outlet, as viewers of this program will recall, last week at the victims' rally in Columbia, South Carolina, State Senator Katrina Sheely made an appearance. And at that rally, in speaking to the victims and standing on the steps of the State House with their families, with victim Chloe Bess, who spoke passionately at that event, Katrina Sheely, state senator, vowed to do everything it takes to get laws passed that fix our broken judicial system. Now, folks, a lot of politicians will talk. A lot of politicians will stand up in front of cameras, in front of microphones. They'll say one thing. Katrina Sheely has never struck me as that kind of elected official. Katrina Sheely is, for those of you who don't know her, kind of a ball buster, folks. She doesn't take anything off of anybody. She's one of the few people in public office that I will criticize her, but I always think once or twice before I do because she's just not one you mess with, folks. She's a tough girl. She's from Red Bank, South Carolina, which tells you a little bit there. She's just a tough girl you don't want to mess with, okay? Especially if you're coming at her with something weak. But Senator Sheely and I had a conversation this week, and I wanted to share a little bit about that. She has not committed to any legislation at this point. She has not drafted any legislation at this point. In fact, it will be until December of this year before bills can be filed for the next legislative session. So we've got a little bit of time between now and the next legislative session for this process to unfold. Obviously, the current session of the General Assembly ended last week, so nothing's going to happen this year. But next year, Senator Sheely has promised to introduce legislation, and I just got to tell you guys, based on the conversation I had with her, I was incredibly encouraged by not only her commitment to this issue, but how open she is to discussing real reforms in the way that judges are selected and elected in this state, which is, again, a process totally controlled totally controlled by state lawmakers. Now, I don't know where Senator Shealy is going to wind up, folks, but I will tell you this. She is looking at every option on the table to reform the way judges are picked in this state. That includes electing them via the public. That includes having the governor appoint them, perhaps with the advice and consent of one chamber or the other. That includes possibly having retention elections for these judges so that once they are appointed, every 2 years or 4 years or however long, the public gets to weigh in on how they're doing. And the other thing I want to just say about Senator Shealy, in addition to looking at all these different options and studying these different options, what has really impressed me is that she's already thinking about, you know, how would they work? How would, you know, what are the pros and the cons to each one of these different models? She's researching what other states are doing. Obviously, South Carolina, one of only two states in the country that has the legislature elect their judges. But just incredibly impressed with what Katrina Shealy has brought to the table up to this point on this debate. And again, we're going to hold her accountable the whole way through. And all lawyers, all lawyer legislators, all members of the General Assembly who take this issue up, because it is this important. It is so important. But I do want to say that the early signs that I've seen from State Senator Katrina Shealy indicate that she is making good on her promise to those victims at that press conference to do whatever it takes to get better laws regarding the selection of judges in South Carolina. All right, so we just talked about the Attorney General. We talked about prosecutions in the state. There were big developments this week in the war against drugs. I've always believed this to be a futile endeavor. I've argued for years for decriminalization, for legalization, not only of marijuana, but many other drugs. I think that this war is a joke. I think we spent over $1 trillion on it with nothing to show for it but more drugs, more death. I do think the more that we move toward decriminalization, we create standardized marketplaces where we can regulate the product. And I think that that's very important because, again, with the fentanyl spike, I mean, it's dangerous out there. In fact, at the press conference we went to this week, one of the assistant attorney generals, Creighton Waters, he made a very good point. He was talking about some of the arrests that they've made in this case, and he made the point that, listen, if one bathroom chemist messes up just this much, adds one little bit too much to a batch, there's all the Narcan in the county's not going to save you, is what he said. And he's right. He's right. It's scary out there, people. But this was a big drug bust. And again, I want to give credit. You know, the laws are what they are right now, and if people are engaged in violent enterprises in pursuit of this illicit activity, you know, I don't object to them being held accountable, even though I believe that the government prohibition against drugs is wrong. But this was a big bust, folks. 34 defendants, more than 120 charges. It's called Los Banditos, and it involves a Mexican cartel called La Familia down in the southern Pacific coast of Mexico, a very influential, powerful cartel. And what happened was a distribution hub had been created in Greenville, South Carolina, which was linked to another hub in Atlanta, which was linked to the cartel's operations. And so this was a massive operation. There were state, local, federal law enforcement agencies involved, state prosecutors handling the case. But what was interesting is it was run out of a Mexican restaurant in Greenville, South Carolina. And not only that, the restaurant was running the distribution through food trucks, through taco trucks. So it was very interesting. We're in the middle, and I got to say this because I enjoyed this very much. Jen Wood, our intrepid researcher, who, by the way, 90% of anything that makes sense on Fitz News, which I'll let you determine that ratio on your own, but it's from Jen Wood. Jen Wood is an absolutely incredible resource for this news outlet. She's just done amazing work, not only in the Murdoch murder story, but a lot of the other stories that we've been covering. She is just sort of the guts of that coverage. She builds the skeleton. We sort of flesh it out. But anyway, Jen Wood was at the press conference with me, and I thought it was funny because, you know, there's this very serious announcement with all these serious prosecutors talking about this big drug bust. And Jen Wood leans into me, and all she says is, "I bet those tacos were good." That's Jen Wood, people. Massive news story, and all she can think about is how good those tacos must have been. Well, guess what? We got one of those tacos, and I wanted to take Jen Wood at her word here and try this thing, and let's give it a shot here. Dylan, There's meth in my taco. It must have been one of those Los Banditos tacos. Man, am I going to get high now? Now I'm really excited about the show. But yeah, that was, how'd that happen, man? A meth in my taco. You know, I do prefer the taco to the sausage, man, but this is... Anyway, back to the story. The Attorney General announcing a major, major drug bust at a taco truck fleet in Greenville, South Carolina. Again, why not just decriminalize, folks? Let's get rid of this black market. Let's standardize this. Let's hold adults accountable for the decisions they make with drugs, just the way we hold them accountable for the decisions they make with alcohol. Again, I don't understand it, but in the meantime, I'm going to try to find a taco truck that doesn't have meth in my tacos. All right, so we're going to transition from a meth-laced taco to a story about gas, which that meth-laced taco did give me some gas. I think I could probably power myself, my own transportation for the next month with that taco. Jeez, Dylan. Anyway, though, I have a 5-minute commute. I'm very fortunate in that the drive from my house to the studio here is only about 5 minutes. But these days, I swear to God, I'm spending about $8 a trip with the way that gas prices are right now. Gas prices in the Palmetto State, across the country, totally out of control, people. Totally out of control. And there's a number of different factors. Certainly, we can talk about the war in Ukraine and the pressure that that's placed on Russian oil and gas supplies. But we also need to talk about something I've been writing on for years, which is energy independence in the United States, something we were moving toward. The current U.S. President Joe Biden has taken us several steps away from that, although I believe he's in the process of reversing some of those decisions, much to the chagrin of the environmental lobby. But look, folks, we have the ability to be energy independent here in the United States. We have that ability if we want to. And in fact, back in 2018, 2019, while politicians of both parties were railing against it, my news outlet supported testing offshore. Again, and I'm still not going to apologize for that. It was the right decision then. It was the right decision now. But Republicans, including former President Donald Trump, backed off of that. They refused to do it. They felt that it would be too dangerous for the environment. I do not agree with that. But at the very least, my argument was this. Let's find out how much oil and gas is there. Let's do the test we need to do to find out how much is there, and then let's make an informed decision. Maybe there's not enough to make it worth the potential environmental risk. Okay, I'm okay with that. But let's find out first. Let's don't shut down the debate before we know what we're dealing with, which is exactly what Democrats, Republicans, and Trump did. Trump wanted to win Florida, folks, and he did, and the price of that was him caving on the offshore drilling issue, or not drilling, but just testing anyway. But a lot of these issues are coming back to the fore this month, this summer, as gas prices begin to spiral just out of control. In South Carolina, we hit a new record mid-May for the cost of a gallon of unleaded gasoline. It's over $4.28, people. That is just off the chart. Diesel's approaching $6, folks. Just numbers we never thought we'd see. And again, if you remember back in COVID, you had average cost of a gallon of regular unleaded under $2. So these are huge spikes, and they impact South Carolinians disproportionately because we are a low-income state. We are a low-income state, and people spend a disproportionately high percentage of the money they make on fuel. Now, I want to talk about this because it goes to something that I've been writing about for years on a host of other fronts. It goes to what are South Carolina leaders, Republican leaders, again, what are they doing about this? What are they doing to make things a little easier on consumers? Because in Georgia, lawmakers and the governor in that state passed a suspension of the gas tax. They suspended Georgia's gas tax while these price spikes are out of control to give motorists some relief. Down in Florida, Ron DeSantis, who obviously a top presidential contender, he also pushed for $1 billion, 6-month gas tax suspension. Unfortunately, the Florida legislature only gave him a month of that, so a much smaller tax cut. But still, It matters. Every penny matters, especially on a tax like this, which everyone has to pay, which is incredibly regressive. Still, it matters. And so you've got leaders in these states, southern states, which, by the way, already have more competitive tax climates than South Carolina. But leaders in these states are going an extra mile to make things a little bit easier for motorists during these difficult times. Now, what are Republicans in South Carolina doing? I am glad you asked that question. Let me tell you what they're doing. First of all, they are not doing anything to ease your pain at the pump. In fact, we are in the fifth year of a six-year gas tax increase that they approved back in 2015, and they're doing absolutely nothing to stop those taxes. In fact, those taxes are going to go up again on July 1. So the pain you're feeling at the pump right now, folks, it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. So this week, the governor of South Carolina had the audacity to go to a press conference with several other political leaders, including the new Speaker of the South Carolina House, Merle Smith, go to a press conference in Florence, South Carolina at Buc-ee's. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Buc-ee's, I just got to tell you, Buc-ee's is a pretty amazing place, right? First of all, it's a convenience store on steroids. It's like a mega mall disguised as a gas station. I don't know if Dr. Evil may be investing in this, but it sounds like the kind of place that they came up with on the set of an Austin Powers movie. It's just unbelievable. But if you've known, I've been once. I went to a Buc-ee's in Daytona, walked in, had to use the restrooms, and I got to tell you, the reports you hear are absolutely true. You could eat off the floor of a restroom in Buc-ee's, and it would be better than like any 5-star restaurant. I mean, it's just immaculate. I mean, I think I saw it sparkle. That may have been an acid flashback, but I'm pretty sure I saw the floor sparkle. But anyway, I walked out of the restroom facilities and was just kind of overpowered by Buc-ee's, and there was a little too much stimulation. I couldn't tell. There was barbecue. There was jerky. There were Buc-ee's bathing suits, and I had to walk out because there was just too much stimulus for me. But also, you walk out, and there's like a row of like 100 gas pumps. I mean, gas pumps literally as long as a football field. So it is a cool place, but here's the problem. The Buc-ee's that opened in Florence, South Carolina this week, which, by the way, one of these politicians who attended the event called it a destination. Said this isn't a convenience store. This is a destination. Well, no, it's not. No, it's not. It's a place that people are going to drive past on their way to more competitive destinations. It's a place people are going to drive past on their way going up to North Carolina, which is cutting taxes for its small businesses and its individual income earners to the tune of $13 billion. Or it's a place that they're going to pass by on their way to Florida, a state where they have no income tax. Okay, so no, this is not a destination. It's a place people are going to drive past. It's a place they may stop if they need to pee, right? Because again, those are some nice bathrooms, man. I'm not even going to lie. But here's the deal. Our politicians could have done something this year to help motorists who are experiencing this just incredibly regressive pressure at the pump, pain at the pump, high taxes at the pump, high prices at the pump. They could have done something. They didn't. What they did was they went and posed with this giant Buc-ee's beaver, glad handing with a beaver. We got Georgia and Florida cutting taxes, South Carolina politicians mugging for pictures with a frickin' beaver, people. That tells you all you need to know about the leadership of the Palmetto State, the Republicans who run this state. And by the way, while we're talking about that, I want to bring something up. You want to know who the last politician in South Carolina to propose a gas tax cut, a gas tax reduction was? It was a Democrat. It was my friend Bakari Sellers. He did it back in 2011. And in proposing that tax cut, then Representative Sellers said he was doing it because it was regressive and it disproportionately impacted poor people. What was true then is true now. And I'm sad to say that just as they do on so many other fronts, the Palmetto State's GOP leaders are not helping. They are not helping. In fact, they are making the situation worse. So, folks, I hope you'll remember that when you go to the polls this fall. Not simply partisan issue. Obviously, the Democrats of this generation are just as bad as the Republicans of this generation. But bottom line, there's a lack of competitiveness. And until we fix it, we're going to continue to lag behind our neighboring southern states. So before we go, there is one other story I wanted to give an update on. We reported on it at length last week. It's the case of Brittany Drexel. Earlier this week, this is probably the biggest story of the week. Earlier this week, Georgetown County Sheriff Carter Weaver held a news conference with state, local, federal law enforcement officials and prosecutors to announce that 62-year-old Raymond Douglas Moody had been charged with murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault in the 13-year-old cold case of Brittany Drexel. It's just a horrific story, folks. This is a 17-year-old girl who came down from Rochester, New York to Myrtle Beach for spring break. She went missing on the evening of April 25th, 2009, had not been seen or heard from since. Literally the last trace of her was a ping of her cell phone near the Charleston-Georgetown County border on the early morning of Sunday, April 26, 2009. Brittany Drexel's case has finally been solved. Her remains were found by investigators earlier this month, and this week, again, Raymond Douglas Moody, a 60-year-old, was charged in connection with that case. So this news outlet covered a lot of the twists and turns of the Brittany Drexel saga, including one involving some folks who were falsely accused by a jailhouse snitch. Now, I believe that's where this story is going to go in the coming days and weeks, as attorneys for that falsely accused individual, his name was Timothy Dequan Taylor. Timothy was accused, along with his father, of abducting, gang raping Brittany Drexel and killing her. And so those allegations obviously proved false. And in fact, my news outlet defended Taylor at the time when he was dragged in by federal authorities on a charge that he'd already pleaded guilty to at the state level, an unrelated charge related to a robbery. They tried him again for the same charge in an effort to kind of squeeze him on this Brittany Drexel case. And it turns out he had nothing to give because he didn't do it. Had nothing to do with it. So anyway, we're going to talk about that because I think that's where this story is going to go in the days and weeks to come. But for now, just wanted to update everyone in our audience about this big story and certainly send our thoughts and prayers to the Drexel family. It's got to be unbelievably difficult for them having to live for so long with the uncertainty, not knowing what happened. And now after 13 years to find out that their daughter died, again, in a very tragic and violent way at the hands of a guy who, by the way, California, this guy spent 21 years in a California prison, raped an 8-year-old girl in California. There are apparently some other crimes that folks are looking into as it relates to this individual, so we could see some additional charges there, but there is at least some resolution on that case, one of the most infamous cold cases, one of the highest profile cold cases in South Carolina, was solved this week. And again, we will continue to update our readers as that saga unfolds in the days and weeks to come. All right, well, that's a wrap for this week's edition. As you may have noticed, I'm wearing a tie. Oh, wait a minute. There's some meth from that taco there. Anyway, so if I'm wearing a tie, it means one of two things. I'm going to the bank or I'm going to court, right? I don't ever wear a tie unless I'm going one of those two places. But anyway, appreciate you tuning in this week. Growing show. Growing audience, loving what we're doing here. Appreciate your support. If you want to support us through advertising, we'd love to have you on the show. Just reach out to us. We're happy to help you there. But most importantly, just keep listening. You can follow the podcast on Apple, on Spotify. You can subscribe to our YouTube page if you want to watch it there. But also keep clicking on Fitz News, the one news outlet in the Palmetto State that is going to hold everybody accountable.